On the one hand, I do think it's a stylistic thing. Modern audiences tend to equate darkness with complexity, and superhero movies, I think, are still somewhat of an adolescent art form, pushing for a greater, more adult complexity of plot and character. But at the same time, when you're dealing with media produced and disseminated on this scale, that cynicism and darkness has to reflect perceptions of the public if it's going to appeal as widely as they do, even if that appeal and perception is sometimes false or unwarranted. Frankly, anyone whose worldview hasn't darkened over the past 18 months should probably have their head examined, so I think superhero movies are definitely capitalizing on that.
The writer Carmen Patacio says the gradual darkening of the American superhero genre says something quite specific about our political reality. Well, jump on board as we take a road trip across America on this special Independence Day edition of The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
You know, we are a movie theater, we're an independent venue, we're a concert venue, we're a comedy venue, we're not a museum for what happened here in 63. However, we do acknowledge what happened here in 63 and we commemorate it when we can.
We'll take a seat inside the cinema where Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested shortly after the death of President Kennedy. And
we wanted to get on to talking about the technology and how we came to making decisions about it, right? The whole film is a metaphor for defending science.
Genetically modified foods, are they really as bad as we think? Well, we'll leave the cornfields of the heartland to stop in New York for a chat with the director of a new documentary that asks just that. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Why are you?
I'm sorry.
Why are you here? There must be a reason for you to be here.
Yes. I'm here to fight for truth and justice in the American way.
You're going to end up fighting every elected official in this country.
Sure you don't really mean that, Lois.
A healthy dose of cynicism from Lois Lane during her first one-on-one with the Man of Steel in 1978's Superman. The amazing stranger from the planet Krypton came to Earth with the mission of giving humans someone to look up to, a reason for hope. It's little wonder, then, that the nation's most prominent newspaper journalist laughed at the audacity of such an idea. This was, of course, Superman's first foray into post-Watergate America.
I don't believe this.
Lois? I never lie.
Welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The United States has just celebrated its first 4th of July under its most divisive president in living history. Regardless of your personal politics, it's safe to say that patriotism in America is in trouble. Today we're taking a road trip across the country in search of some of the movies and cinematic locations that have told us something unique about American culture. Our first stop is a small, middle American town best known for its corn crops and mysterious UFO sightings.
Well, you know what the problem is?
I don't know. Too much mayonnaise?
Mayonnaise? Donald loved mayonnaise. Why would you think that was the problem? No, the problem is, why do I stay in Smallville? Believe me, I've asked myself the same question. Do you know how lucky you are to live in Metropolis, the big apricot?
Smallville may be a fictional town, but the roots of its existence stem from the heart of what might be called classic Americana. Its depiction often reflects the wholesome cereal box idealism of a Norman Rockwell painting, as referenced by a character in the Smallville television series of the early 2000s. But this picture-perfect vision of small-town America doesn't just serve as a backdrop for the original superhero's childhood. In most interpretations of the Superman mythology, Smallville is a place from the past.
And now, some years later, the child is young Clark Kent, a student at Smallville High School, where his meek, retiring manner hides an exciting secret known only to himself and his foster parents. The secret that Clark...
When we visit Smallville, whether in the pages of a comic book or via film or television, it's often part of a flashback, a memory of some idyllic childhood encounter. With a thriving high street and local industries, a sturdy small-town newspaper, and proud citizens, Smallville represents a nostalgic portrait of American innocence, a stark contrast to the big city chaos of Metropolis and intergalactic battles of Superman's later years. It's a cornfield memory to which we'd all love to return, had it ever really existed in the first place.
Gee, Mr. Kent, what a breakfast Kellogg's Sugar Smacks make, huh?
That's right, Jimmy. That's why I never let business interfere with this meal.
While the superhero blockbuster may have really started with 1978's Superman, the genre never really sunk in until Sam Raimi's 2002 film Spider-Man, starring Tobey Maguire. That film became the first to take more than $100 million in its opening weekend. The series gets its third reboot this week with Spider-Man Homecoming, which presents a markedly younger Peter Parker, now occupying the same world as Marvel's other big-screen heroes, such as Iron Man and Captain America. So, if Christopher Reeve's Superman gave us an American idealism after the fall of Richard Nixon, what do today's superhero popcorn blockbusters tell us about our current reality?
Finally, here we go.
Good evening, Peter.
Whoa!
You have 576 possible web shooter combinations.
That is awesome.
In general, I think that they serve the same purpose as a lot of foundational myths have in previous civilizations.
That's Carmen Patacio, a writer based in Miami, Florida. His articles for The Atlantic and other magazines have explored the many ways in which our fears and flaws as a society are reflected via the safe medium of popular culture.
They give people a comforting fantasy of an ordered moral universe and a kind of shared foundational myth that disconnected people and form a nation. I think, you know, stories define a nation as much as the people do.
I would say that superhero movies, they're often written off as blockbuster popcorn fare. In the case of so many of those films, that's very much true. But quite often they touch upon some serious subject matter as well, even if we don't always realize it. I'm thinking of scenes in the recent Wonder Woman film where the central character, of course, discovers the horror of chemical weapons. There's also parallels between the villains in The Dark Knight Rises and the Islamic State as well. Superman has often been treated as a bit of a metaphor, an allegory to the atomic bomb. What do you think that superhero stories and the political messages inside them tell us about the real world that we inhabit?
I think the great irony of a lot of these superhero movies is that they often end up addressing the very same topics that most moviegoers go to the theater to avoid. You have like a lot of good examples there, but I'm also thinking of the questions of interventionism in Avengers Civil War, the mass surveillance sequences in The Dark Knight, ethics of the military-industrial complex in Iron Man. And I think, you know, it's super important that mass media tries to interrogate these issues, but a lot of these superhero movies almost always fail in these attempts, which I think is why a lot of their climaxes are similarly incoherently violent or nonsensical. The sort of simple resolution that the stories of these superheroes demands are in conflict with the complicated forces at play underneath the surface.
I would say I have a highbrow taste in movies sometimes, but I always love a good superhero movie as well. How do you feel when people say to you that superhero movies, oh, they're just silly, you know, they're a waste of time. It's just an excuse to sit down in front of the cinema and not think for 2 hours. Do you agree with that kind of sentiment?
I think there are certainly superhero movies that fit that appeal, but for the most part, these are like the dominant cultural product of, it's what most people are seeing when they think of America. And it's the way that we are kind of projecting ourselves to the world in, I mean, these 1% of the population goes out and see these movies every time they come out. So to dismiss them as unimportant or that they're not dealing with vital subjects, I think is short-sighted. And I certainly think they're going to attest to the time in retrospect, 20 years down the line, people will look at the appeal of superhero movies and understand how important they were, even if they were seen as just blockbuster fare in the present.
Superman, as played by Christopher Reeve, he was very much a hero, and that was not something that was contested by that story at all.
It was his driving force as a character. It was even his mission set out for him in actual words in the script by his father, Jor-El, as played by Marlon Brando, of course. That also turned out to be his weakness, though. He cared for people who may even wish to see him destroyed. That, of course, was the character's lesson for humanity. But that script, Superman, by starring Christopher Reeve, that was written in conjunction with the sequel, Superman 2. And, of course, that featured a scene in which the President of the United States willingly gives in to General Zod in order to save the people of the not just the United States, but of the world. So it did have quite a rose-tinted view of America, of American politics, of American society. And given this was so soon after what was happening with Watergate, how do you see that? Is that something that was responding to the political reality of the time? Or perhaps was this the movie world trying to remain perhaps a little too optimistic given what was really happening in the world?
You have to go back to the sort of origins of superhero movie, or at least comic books and superheroes in the American culture, and that they came to prominence and cultural renown immediately after and during World War II, in which America came to see itself as a superhero in the world, an invincible defender of truth and justice. And then I think if you look at that relative to why they become popular now in the wake of 9/11 and the war on terror, America was revealed to be more vulnerable than it thought, far less just than it thought. And these myths have come in to fill, they've swooped in like superheroes to reassure the American public that these very harsh realities are not the case.
I would say detractors of superhero movies, they often point to the invulnerability of these characters as being innately silly. That's one of the main reasons that I think people often come to me when they're surprised that I respond so well to superhero stories, that the fact that these men and women running around in funny outfits have these superhuman powers makes them completely silly. Even when you consider these stories in a real-world setting, there really is nothing that Superman could have done to prevent the election of someone like Donald Trump. For example, even if you wind it back to the comic book stories, there have always been long-running story arcs in which a supervillain Lex Luthor is elected as president, and there's nothing that Superman could do to prevent that. The parallels are striking. The Supergirl television series explores that angle quite effectively. So, you know, she can save a passenger jet from crashing, but she can't stop people from making unwise decisions. Unless, of course, she inspires them on a human-to-human level. Despite being from other worlds and other planets a lot of the time, shouldn't these superhero stories actually just be good human stories? And in many cases, isn't that really what they are? They're about us, aren't they?
Couldn't agree more. The appeal of going back to the Greek gods, the appeal was that they were still slave to human failings and trappings, and the draw of modern superhero stories should be no different. A lot of the movies fail to realize this because they don't fully imbue their stories with human emotion or stakes. The DC movies sort of play like incomplete nightmares, and a lot of the Marvel movies are basically calculated brand management. But I think there are very distinct and successful and human exceptions. The recent movie Logan, I thought, was excellent because unlike these cross-promotional properties that are dominating now the superhero stories, it was like an extremely focused and intimate story, and its characters were vulnerable and mortal. It's a Western kind of before it's a superhero movie, and that small distinction makes all the difference. And when I think of my favorite superhero movies I don't know if people would classify these as superhero movies, but like Unbreakable, The Iron Giant, even the recent Planet of the Apes reboot, which the Andy Serkis Caesar character is a type of superhero. The heroes aren't really concerned with saving the world. They're concerned with preserving their own humanity when faced with the prospect of having great power.
Live as one of them, Kal-El. To discover where your strength and your power are needed. Always hold in your heart the pride of your special heritage. They can be a great people, Kal-El. They wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all, their capacity for good. I have sent them you, my only son.
The writer Carmen Patatio speaking to me from Miami, Florida. Still to come, we will pay a visit to a cinema in Dallas that played an unexpected role in American history on the 22nd of November, 1963. But first, let's take a look at this week's box office. Wonder Woman continues to conquer the box office, sitting comfortably at number 3 and topping $715 million. When grouped together with its other DC Extended Universe films, namely Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, and Suicide Squad, the series pushes past $3 billion worldwide. If that wasn't quite enough, coming this November, Justice League hits theaters, introducing both The Flash and Aquaman, before he gets his own film next year. But of course, Wonder Woman is the first of the franchise so far to attract good reviews. Will Warner Brothers take note of just how lucrative, positive word of mouth can be? Coming in at second place is the action movie Baby Driver, starring Kevin Spacey, Jamie Foxx, and Mad Men's John Hamm. The film's impressive, eye-catching poster design no doubt helped it surpass $35 million in the US. And rounding out at number one, Despicable Me 3 from Universal Pictures and Illumination Entertainment, which has taken $86 million in the US so far. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. If you visit Dallas, you'll find a giant B next to a giant G in almost every neighborhood. You can stand in the center of the two letters and become the I to spell the word big for a souvenir photograph. The tourism slogan for the city of Dallas is Big Things Happen Here. Propensity for such largesse has caused, among other things, a scourge of housing inequality investigated by the federal government. The New York Times writer Carol Huang wrote that economic growth in Dallas surged north on the map, beginning in the 1960s because the city turned away in shame from the great American tragedy that happened downtown on the 22nd of November, 1963.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Questions and myths grew like walls around the trauma experienced in the city and the nation. The Warren Commission found that shooter Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in killing the president. Even today, of course, not everyone believes that to be true. Director Oliver Stone enraged critics when he prodded at the holes in the story through conspiracy theorist and New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner in his 1991 film JFK.
Nitrate tests indicate he hadn't even fired a rifle on November 22nd. And on top of that, they didn't even bother to see if the rifle had been fired that day.
He had his palm print on the weapon.
Well, it went to the FBI, Bill. The FBI didn't find a thing. It comes back a week later, and one guy in the Dallas Police Department suddenly finds a palm print. For all we know, it could have been taken off Oswald in the morgue. There's no chain of evidence.
Yeah, I never could figure out why this guy orders a traceable weapon to this post office box when he can go into any store in Texas, give a phony name, and walk out with a rifle which can never be traced.
Lee Harvey Oswald remains a fixture in Dallas, and not always as the villain of America's dream. Such is the fascination surrounding him. Many observers seem to be on a constant quest to pin something on him, be it guilt, innocence, or just enigma. Oswald was, of course, arrested just 45 minutes after President Kennedy was shot, and the arrest happened inside the Oak Cliff Theatre. The picture house is still operating today, and, needless to say, many people pay a visit just to see where Oswald was sitting on that day. In this report produced by Lindsay Connect, Barack Epstein, a force of the Texas film industry who runs the cinema, shows us around.
We have the original poster of the movie War is Hell, which was the movie that was playing the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was cut. It was the movie he was watching, even though he only watched probably 10 minutes of it. A guy named Johnny Brewer, who worked at the shoe store four doors down, saw him come in.
Well, right after the president was shot, they broadcast an inscription on the radio of this man of 5'8", 5'9", 150 pounds. And just a few minutes before he walked into the lobby, on the radio they had a bulletin that an officer had been shot here in Oak Cliff. And he walked in, he matched the description. Looked scared, just the way he stood there.
Dallas police were called and they were here and they caught him. This particular poster is signed by Johnny Brewer and also the actor in the movie, Tony Russell. that Johnny Brewer wrote, I pointed out where Oswald was sitting in the Texas theater to Officer McDonald, row 3, seat 2, and witnessed the arrest. And then this other one for the Texas theater, my first movie, Oswald's Last, Tony Russell, Sergeant Kiefer. War is Hell is actually sort of a lost movie. It doesn't really exist. There's only a silent version, which is like 8 minutes, and then about 15 minutes of a second reel of it, and we've edited them together. One of the other partners here, Jason Eimer, made an original score. Everyone asks where Oswald's seat is. People come in just off the street and they want to see the seat and leave, not even hang out. So that's fine. We try to be accommodating when possible. And if we can, we'll show them the two seats. So there's the third row from the back, center section. It's the fifth seat and also the second seat. Now, the reason we always talk about two seats is sort of a famous DPD photo of an officer pointing at the fifth seat. But it's also well known that he moved to the second seat, and that's where Officer McDonald basically had a fist fight with him. And it's also where it was mentioned on the poster that Johnny Brewer pointed to him. You know, we are a movie theater, we're an independent venue, we're a concert venue, we're a comedy venue. We're not a museum for what happened here in 63. However, we do acknowledge what happened here in 63, and we commemorate it when we can, but it is not our main reason for being here. I feel like Dallasites enough have to deal with someone coming in from out of town and being like, what do you want to go see? Oh, the grassy knoll. Of course, that's where you want to go see. It's bad enough that that's our main tourist attraction. I feel like there's ways to commemorate what happened and also, you know, show that the Dallas police were empowered and victorious, and that they caught the bad guy here.
Did you kill the president?
No, I've not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about it was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
We have shirts with our series that we call Tuesday Night Trash. We have stuff for our film festival. We have shirts that have Howard Hughes' face on them. And then we also have one of the arrest photo of Lee Harvey Oswald. We have the Zapruder camera shirt.
Let's go to Dallas now for developments there today. Dan Rather reporting.
We have just returned from seeing a complete motion picture of the moments preceding and the moments of President Kennedy's assassination and the shooting of Texas Governor John Connally.
Is there a t-shirt that features something having to do with the film?
With the camera, yeah.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Yes. I didn't know that. I'm Alexandra Zapruder. I'm the granddaughter of Abraham Zapruder, who took the home movie of President Kennedy's assassination. And the book that I wrote on the subject is called 26 Seconds, A Personal History of the Zapruder Film. It's very interesting, I mean, to me to hear that. I wasn't aware of that, although I certainly, of course, am well aware of the you know, what I would call really the fetishizing of the film and our grandfather and our name. In as much as the film has been mythologized and has been fetishized and people have obsessed over it and examined it and have taken our name and used it, you know, for their film companies or their magazines or, you know, it's become now a verb, you know, that means to look at something, scrutinize it, you know, over and over again and all that sort of thing. But there were real people who, you know, there is a family whose name is Zapruder, and that's our family. And the complexities of that story and the nuances of that story are instructive in a lot of ways. But you lose all of that when our name, you know, or the camera or the images of the film become a kind of shorthand to stand in for something else.
I get out and about a half hour earlier and get into a good spot to shoot some pictures. And I found a spot, one of these concrete blocks that I have down near that park near the underpass. And I got on top there, there was another girl from my office. She was right behind me. And as I was shooting, as the president was coming down from Houston Street making his turn. It was about halfway down there. I had a shot. And he slumped to the side like this. Then I had another shot or two. I couldn't say what it was, one or two. And I saw his head practically open up, all blood and everything. And I kept on shooting. That's about all. I'm just sick.
I think that pretty well expresses the entire feelings of the whole world.
It really put a bad name on Dallas for so many years, and now I think everybody's gotten so liberal it doesn't make that much of a difference like it did a long time ago. But Harry Hall, I used to own Lee Harvey's. This is just a fun place to be. It has a name that, I mean, everybody recognizes. So, I mean, if you were to look on the internet and says, okay, you know, what bars would I go to if when I go to Dallas or something? Lee Harvey's.
Let's change the room slightly and imagine another kind of apartness. The outsider who builds a plot around his desperation. A self-watcher. A lonely young man. Living in a fiction he hasn't bothered to put down on paper. But this doesn't mean he isn't organized. He organizes everything. This is how he keeps from disappearing.
An extract from Don DeLillo's 1988 novel, Librum, ending that report by Lindsay Connect. We also heard from Alexandra Zapruder, an author and granddaughter of Abraham Zapruder, who recorded the famous 26-second footage showing President Kennedy's death. Still to come, we'll touch down in New York for a look at a new documentary that seeks to change the dialogue surrounding how and what we eat. Stay tuned. Mubi takes the front seat on our American road trip this week with a couple of films from very different chapters of the history books. Traveling the dusty plains with conflicted heroes, the great films of the Western genre posed some thorny questions to Americans via the safe distance of the cinema screen. Coming at a time when the genre became just a little bit darker, 1957's 310 to Yuma is a serious character study that just happens to fit the Western mold. And making its world premiere is The Republic, from James N. Kanitz Wilkins, whose work is part of the official selection at the Whitney Biennial. The film depicts a group of libertarian men living a life of free will and self-reliance in rural America, bonded by their common belief in a sovereign state. Catch 310 to Yuma and The Republic, plus a whole bunch of other titles too, right now for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. There's been a steady flow of films over the past few years telling us all about our broken food system and the evils of genetically modified organisms. But now, a new documentary is going against that grain by asking whether it might be time people reassessed the evidence for and against GMOs. Food Evolution is a call to science that looks to prove that genetically modified foods, on a case-by-case basis at least, aren't always the evils envisioned in the popular imagination. But of course, a film like this one is always going to ignite at least some controversy, and director Scott Hamilton Kennedy was there to defend it when he met Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker.
So I was approached, and then I brought in my producing and writing partner, Trey Sheehan, by IFT, the Institute of Food Technologists, who are food scientists. And they reached out to a bunch of filmmakers, dare I say, of my stature. They wanted to make a theatrically released film. They wanted to make a film that would get press like this. And they said they want to make a film on food, science, and some of the issues of 9 billion in 2050, that our population is going up screechingly fast from 7.2 billion to about 9 billion by 2050. And by some estimates, we have to make more food, create more food, grow more food, produce more food in the next 34 years than in the last 10,000. So we were like, holy crap, that's not a movie. That's too enormous. Well, I can't make that movie. But let's go research and see what issues are out there that could fall under that umbrella. And the GMO story was just waving its hands, that it was about food. It was about sustainability. It was about safety. It was about trust. It was global. And it didn't seem the story was being told correctly. I mean, I knew a little bit about GMOs, but I had no idea that the papaya industry in Hawaii was saved from GE, from GMO technology, and all these other stories. So yeah, it was, the great moment was when Trace and I looked at each other and were like, even if IFT doesn't pick us to make this movie, we're going to go make this movie because it's just too good.
I guess there are a lot of interests involved with this. Obviously, science has answers, but I guess they also have their own interests as well.
Well, you're talking about conflict of interest. Yes, conflict of interest is a real thing, but if we use it as a blanket problem, like anybody that's funded by anything, we can't listen to them.
You have a go at some of the people who are funded by Whole Foods and others. So what's the difference in your case?
No, it's an excellent question. And I don't have a problem with anybody getting funding from anywhere. I mean, I guess I could have problems with funding from the KKK or something extreme like that. But it isn't about who your funder is. It's about were you asked to promise results and did you promise results? Were you asked to promise a story and did you promise a story? Were you asked to promise a film? Did you promise a film? And we weren't asked to promise a film and we didn't promise a film. I had final cut, creative control. I said that from the beginning and we went on this journey and this is the story that we found. So a lot of people are trying to use conflict of interest as a way to try and take down this film. And we say, go to the data. Go to the film, talk to us about individual moments in the film. But if you're going to use, again, conflict of interest as a blanket shutdown, I don't know what to say to that because I can't read the New York Times. I can't read the Washington Post. I can't watch CNN. I can't watch 60 Minutes. I can't do anything. If it's just going to be a blanket, you got to take it case by case.
This topic of GMOs, which, you know, you cover in the documentary, it seems to ignite not only such strong opinions, but also, I guess, preconceptions that are ultimately often wrong. Why do you think that is the case?
It's an excellent question and something we've struggled with for a long time, right? What motivates people, right? So I've come to use the phrase, the limitations of well-intentioned liberals, not to make this just a liberal or non-liberal issue, but I think a lot of people come to the food conversation. If you look at the foodie movement, a lot of people come to this saying, I want to have safe food. I want to have nutritious food. I want to have local food, if that's an issue, like smaller carbon footprint and things like that. And they were kind of handed a perfect storm of distrust and issues around food that then became a rallying cry for anything they didn't see falling under that umbrella. And GMOs was one of those things that they thought, good foodie decisions over here, bad foodie decisions are big food, which is obviously an extremely vague term, and GMOs fell under that as well. And they didn't look into the nuance of what does that mean? And that's what we wanted to do.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that this GMO umbrella is simply too broad. The fact that it encompasses so much from, you know, big multinationals to people who are genuinely trying to help countries in Africa produce drought-resistant crops, for example.
That's exactly right. More to the point, in our film, we were taking on the banana wilt disease. But yeah, that's exactly it. So it's a case by case. One of our big mantras with the film was GMOs are not a product, they're a process. And they're not owned by any one industry, any one company. We all know which company I'm referring to. It's Monsanto, the big M. That's who everybody fears. And that even in defending GMOs on a case-by-case basis, we are in no way defending a hall pass for any large corporation or anybody with means and power to abuse that power, right? We have to separate these things.
Do you think that you could have been more probing with a company like Monsanto? Do you think some people may see it as a bit of an apology for that company?
We've definitely been accused of that. I've never seen a company more hated than Monsanto. So absolutely. I mean, if you felt that way, the audience is never wrong, right? If you wanted to see that film where I dig in on Monsanto more, okay, that's fine. Do we have more footage with Monsanto? Absolutely. We didn't want Monsanto to take over the film. They've always been the gorilla in the room, and we knew we had to deal with them, but we wanted to get past them, right? We wanted to get on to talking about the technology and how we came to making decisions about it, right? The whole film is a metaphor for defending science, right? GMOs is just a single topic, right? Neil deGrasse Tyson didn't take the film to defend GMOs. He took the film to defend science and how we make decisions.
Obviously, there's a lot of films out there about, you know, the so-called evils of GMO. Were you surprised that there wasn't really much showing the other side?
Absolutely. It was one of the biggest inspirations for making this film. I mean, there's films out there like GMO OMG or Seed, even elements of Food Inc., where they are saying some very, very scary things about GMOs that most often, if not almost 100% of the time, are not founded. And worse is they don't show one positive element. They don't find Dennis Gonzalez in Hawaii. They don't find Pam Ronald at UC Davis. They don't find golden rice. They don't find the banana problem in Uganda. So by leaving those things out, what are they trying to do? And it troubles me sometimes because it feels like propaganda.
Do you still think there are bad uses of GMO having done this film? Or do you think that it's all good?
Again, an excellent question. It's case by case. So Neil gets this question. People come up to him and they, Neil deGrasse Tyson, our wonderful narrator and script consultant, he'll get cornered at a book signing and people say, are you still pro-GMO? And he goes, I'm not pro-GMO, I'm pro-science. And currently the science tells us that all the GMOs on the market today are safe for the environment and safe for us.
Scott Hamilton Kennedy there, the director of the documentary Food Evolution, which opened in New York last week. Check out foodevolutionmovie.com for local screening dates. And that's all for this week's program. Next week, it's our summer special. We'll take off to some of our favorite warm weather destinations for a dose of cinema under the stars. Today's show was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffan. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.